Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. Today we have a fascinating new 2021 OUP publication called Print and the Urdu Public, Muslims, Newspapers, and Urban Life in Colonial India. We'll be speaking with the book's author, of course, Dr. Megan Eaton-Robb. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, is your subtitle a misnomer? What's the book about?
The subtitle is not a misnomer. The book is about there are two ways of thinking about what the book is about. One is to think about the case study that it focuses on, a fascinating Urdu language newspaper named Medina that was founded in 1912 by a remarkable man who was a proprietor of the newspaper, Maulana Majid Hassan. And another way to think about the book, aside from this newspaper that was an important anti-colonial voice, but also an important voice that contested in really productive ways national party politics, another way to think about the book is to think about its theoretical interventions. It's interested in thinking about why it's important to consider alignments with space and time when we're defining public spheres. So in the academic context, as you know, there's this vibrant conversation about what constitutes a public. And my book argues that it's important to acknowledge that what constitutes a public can vary pretty dramatically according to the alignments that a public makes with certain specific geographic places. And in this book, what really comes to the fore is the relationship between the public that this newspaper is engaged with and the Qasba, or the Islamicate small town in colonial India. And another way of thinking, the other kind of theoretical approach to the book is that we should take lithographed newspapers pretty seriously as sources that tell us something about everyday Muslim life and piety. And so I'm tackling these two theoretical tasks by, you know, localizing the public and taking lithographed newspapers seriously by focusing on this fascinating case study of a previously understudied newspaper called Medina. And it was published in a Qasba called Bijnor.
Yes, you've touched on a number of the aspects of the book there very eloquently. Let's focus a little bit on the newspaper itself. Tell us a bit about that newspaper.
I'm excited I like to start this story every time. So in 1912, in a small Qasba, Bijnor in British India, a man named Majid Hassan, he would later earn the title of Maulana, not through education, but through the popular acclaim of the people who read and appreciated his newspaper. In 1912, Majid Hassan sold actually his wife's jewelry with her permission to receive the money to found the newspaper Medina. So it certainly was a financial risk when he founded the paper. And the newspaper pledged to be the friend of the mulk, so and the life of the Qom. So the friend of the nation and the life of the Qom here was referring to the Muslim community specifically. And Medina went on to become one of the most successful newspapers of any language circulating in North India and the Punjab. So in 1922 specifically, it had the largest circulation of any paper that was circulating in the northern half of the subcontinent, at least. And what's fascinating is that the newspaper's success was not something that most observers would have been able to predict because of its origins in a small town. But Majid Hassan was able to leverage really influential and expert networks of journalists, calligraphers, as well as printing specialists in order to gain a strong reputation for his newspaper. And what was also really interesting about this newspaper, it was published in Urdu and it was published using lithographic technology, is that it began to, and really from the start, emphasized a connection between the Urdu language community and Islam. And so as you know, I mean, the connection between Urdu and Islam is very recent, really, and it's something that needs to be historicized. But what I find really interesting and exciting about this case study is I think that these newspapers that connected Urdu and Islam are part of the puzzle of how Urdu and Islam became so closely connected in the public imagination in the first half of the 20th century. So Medina certainly has many tales of anti-colonial resistance, fighting against censorship, trying to evade censorship. And we can talk about more of those specific anecdotes, during this conversation, if you like. And it ultimately, although initially it was both committed to the Muslim League and the Congress when those weren't mutually exclusive, ultimately it became much more supportive of the Congress party. And was very critical of the Muslim League and its calls for Pakistan. So in that sense, it's also an important aspect of Indian history, of a very influential Urdu publication that connected Islam with Congress politics and with the founding of an independent India.
In addition to the newspaper itself, what else do you look at? What other sources are you examining in your book?
That's a great question. So the newspaper, of course, is the core of my archival information. I was able to find a full collection of the newspaper at the University, Royal Holloway University of London. But aside from that, I look at archival documents from the colonial sources. So one of the side effects of the stringent censorship and surveillance is that there that existed under British colonial rule is that there are a number of granular sources that offer information about circulation numbers, about the names and financial status of the proprietors and editors of some of these newspapers. And so these documents were often referred to as the statements of the vernacular, quote unquote, vernacular newspapers. And I benefited from making reference to those. But I also found, I searched in diary entries and correspondence where I could find it, as well as tazkiras of local Bijanoris. So there are some tazkiras recording influential locals and what their contributions to the local community were. I certainly benefited from reference to those as well. And I also did an aspect of I benefited from several informational interviews with the descendants of Maulana Majid Hassan, who still live in the Haveli where Medina newspaper was printed, and still remember when Medina was under production, because it continued being produced until a few years after Maulana Majid Hassan's death in the early 1970s. And I also trained as a novice lithographer to get a sense of how the newspaper was actually being produced at on a day-to-day level. And so there was also an aspect of hands-on ethnographic work, if you will, or maybe autoethnographic work to get a sense of empathy and hands-on experience to think about what are the questions I should be asking about how an Urdu newspaper really came into being in the early 20th century.
What would you say is the core takeaway, the core conclusion in terms of the data? We'll also talk about the theory. What would you say is the core conclusion about what you're studying?
Well, I think that for an academic monograph, there are the conclusion is fairly theoretical, right? That that the public, that Urdu newspapers were contributing to the creation of, should be considered with reference to its grounding in the Qasba as a as an authentic space for its readers, and also it should be understood with reference to a Muslim past. So the fact that the past was regularly and intricately interwoven into contemporary news stories, and the accounts of historical figures from that were directly linked to Islam stood alongside contemporary news accounts, reaffirming this sense of an intertwining of the past and present in a way that really, as many scholars have touched on in previous works as well, linear time doesn't really help us understand the productive relationship between past and present that helped imagine other futures. So I think that this concept of, space and time as an important aspect of the public sphere that's been underappreciated in the past is that core takeaway that I wanted to explore. But also the importance of newspapers for historians, not just as sources that can help us corroborate when certain things happened or didn't happen, which is how historians have tended to use newspapers in the past as kind of more or less throwaway items that are useful as kind of backing up, evidence of certain occurrences, but otherwise not particularly interesting as artifact in itself. I'm hoping what my book does is builds on the really exciting work that's being done on considering newspapers as items of historical merit in their own right. And this is one reason why I spent so much time trying to learn how the newspapers were produced. They deserve to be considered as historical sources with a material culture as well, tied to communities. For instance, Maulana Majid Hassan's press was a community. The editors of the newspaper lived in the home when the newspaper was being published, and there were in the kind of complex itself, there were separate apartments for the families of the editors to live in, some relative privacy. And this indicates it's not only a reflection of the fact that the newspapers were built upon very strong, kinship and relational networks, but also it hints at the fact that the newspaper is only one part of this really vibrant conversation, right? That's happening in the community of newspaper publishers and editors. So just to kind of in brief, the first big thing is, okay, we need to think about space and time as important aspects of understanding how publics were functioning. And this is, and then the second thing is to think about newspapers as something we take seriously, not just as things that help us pin down dates for events.
Fascinating. Now, regarding the first overarching core takeaway, I think it's worthwhile to probe a little more deeply about what you have to say about this idea of public as timescape.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yes, absolutely. So I think that timescape is a term that I certainly did not invent, but what I think it does help us do is think about pushing upon some of the existing and very well-established concepts of what constitutes a public sphere. So if we look at how the understanding of the public developed over time, We're very influenced by the ideas of Jürgen Habermas, who established a thought about the public as something that stood in opposition to the government, as a kind of corrective or a separate space for the debating and hashing out of ideas, right? And understandings of the public sphere have also been very strongly influenced by Benedict Anderson's concept of imagined community, which basically established the conditions for the rise of nationalism. So both of those lineages have been pretty important when thinking about how we understand publics. And Habermas is depending on a notion of individual subjectivity when he's talking about the members of the public that are involved in that conversation. And critics have certainly pointed out in the past that these types of individual kind of enlightenment inflected subjectivities aren't necessarily going to apply in the same way when we're thinking about a different South Asian contexts. And Benedict Anderson, even though he's talking about the founding of the nation rather than explicitly about publics, because he depends so heavily on print capitalism as one of the conditions for the rise of the nation itself, he thinks about this notion of imagined community as becoming modular. So it develops in like this in the South American colonial context and gets basically taken out, implanted into the European context, and at some point it gets exported to the South Asian subcontinent. And the implication is that print capitalism is interacting with societies in more or less the same way everywhere that print capital extends or penetrates. And for me, this never really rung true when I was looking at how print capitalism developed in the South Asian subcontinent. So among those writing and publishing in Urdu or in Persian, the printing press as developed in Europe was very unattractive because it wasn't able to preserve the beauty or even sometimes the legibility of the written word. Once lithography, so this form of printing that used a lithographic stone that was capable of soaking in ink in kind of positive areas and repelling ink in negative areas to print more nuanced images. Once this printing technology arrived, mass printing really took off among those writing in the Urdu and Persian script. That only happened after 1800. And so although previous research into newspapers has assumed that newspapers that emerged in South Asia were building off of Western models only, my research really uncovered a different lineage of influences. Instead, I think that newspapers were building off of akhbarat, so Persian newsletters and correspondence that was circulated among both kinship networks as well as professional networks between ghazbas and larger urban spaces, and also building on top of very vibrant and rich correspondence networks. And I think that by unearthing the influence of these types of literary or genre influences instead of Western newspapers, what it points to is really distinctive history of print capitalism in South Asia that developed quite independently from the modular forms that Anderson laid out. Okay, so all of this is to say that the timescape, what I think it does very well is it thinks about the aspects of the public that are not given as much attention in an Andersonian framework or a Habermasian framework. It thinks about how time can have a different relationship to how public thinks about itself in the South Asian context. And it also says that we should pay really close attention to how public conversations relate themselves to certain spaces as sources of authenticity. And so Medina very, very specifically grounded its authenticity in the Ghazwa. At some point, in response to the publication of a very controversial literary work on Gaudi, it actually posted a couplet that translates as, you know, no calamity can reach the seclusion of solitude. And what its reference was, the reference there was that in the Ghazwa, kind of isolated from the westernized city, the publishers and writers in Medina were in some ways protected from the danger, in many ways, protected from the dangers of westernization. And that created an authentic voice that really spoke to many of its readers.
What subfields does your book impact, or otherwise put? Who might be interested in this book?
I think that it's one of those books that sits at the intersection of multiple fields, which is both a good thing and also a challenge.
That's why I asked the question.
Yeah, exactly. So I was trained as a historian and also inflected with area studies, and I am currently in a religious studies department. So I think that this book has something, certainly something to say to historians, certainly something useful to add to area studies conversations, South Asian studies. I think it and hope it will be useful for religious studies scholars, Islamic studies scholars, for those interested in social and cultural historical aspects of Islamic studies. And those are the major disciplinary interlocutors that I envision. Although I have had really productive conversations with literary studies scholars as well. You know, those thinking about Urdu from the literary perspective, and this is partly because the newspaper itself, in some ways, is sometimes it can be complicated to see it as a form of literature because it was a very lowbrow form of writing at times. But I think that it certainly merits being treated as a collection of literary genres as well.
Listen, as someone who studies the Puranas, I'm well aware of genres of texts that are considered lowbrow compared to other texts. I'm also well aware of their value for tuning us to lived experiences. Say a word about the structure of the book. Walk us through the book.
Great. My introduction really lays out the theoretical interventions that I've talked a lot about so far today. The first chapter, it's called Putting the Public House of Medina on the Muslim Map. And it really gives a close, fine-grained account of how the newspaper itself developed, its lineage of initial editors that helped establish its reputation, also influential calligraphers who were writing for or helping produce the newspaper that helped give Medina the reputation for beautiful production value. And it kind of lays the groundwork for how this band of individuals with a very relatively rapid rotation in its cast of characters ended up garnering a great deal of influence. And in the case of Majid Hassan, a great deal of personal political influence in the Congress Party as things drew closer and closer to independence. The second chapter, it's called Back to the Future Ghazwa. And it talks about it pays close attention to the relationship of time in the newspaper. So here is where I do some close reading about conversations around time, the setting alongside of historical figures next to contemporary newspaper accounts to demonstrate the ways that on a daily basis, the newspaper was certainly interwoven into the lives of its readers, but also it took its commitment to keeping the past alive in the present and as part of the imagined future. It kept that emphasis alive through its weekly publication. The third chapter is on Urdu lithography. So it is the first account of how an Urdu lithographic newspaper would come into being at a pretty granular level. So the layout of the editorial office, how the Haveli itself was set up, the printing processes that were being used, and how it was shipped. And I see this as a very practical contribution, but also very important in thinking about how, you know, a technology that by itself, of course, isn't religious, you know, in any essential way, how it came to be connected with Islam in this case, because of the lithographic technology's ability to reproduce this beautiful script. That was being, and I talk a little bit about there's how an elision between Urdu, Persian, and Arabic kind of begins to emerge through the ways that visuals are employed in the newspaper. Sorry, then the fourth chapter is called Viewing the Map of Europe Through the Lens of Islam. And this gets more into a kind of discursive analysis of how the newspaper thought about itself. And was hashing out aspects of social, cultural, political, and religious identity through looking at and critiquing your aspects of European civilization. And then I conclude the book by looking at a series of really fascinating case studies called, it's called Provincializing Policies Through the Urdu Public. And what it does is it says, okay, once the newspaper had developed its reputation, once it had built all of this social capital, how ultimately was it used? And so one of the key case studies that I explore is the 1937 by-election in Bijnor and Medina's very influential role in that drama.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. Was there anything else about the book that you wanted to mention?
Well, I think that we've, I think that the fascinating thing about the paper is in individual kind of anecdotes and stories that emerge about the newspaper over time. But overall, I think we have a good general grasp of it. I don't want to anticipate any other questions that you might have.
No, it's a scenic route, right? You can feel free to share any of the anecdotes you'd like. Okay. One thing that I often ask, sometimes out of my own sheer curiosity, I usually find out from your preface, but the audience may not know yet. How did you get into this? Why are you interested in this? How did you end up researching this stuff?
Yes. Thank you for that question. Well, it's not always easy to explain. I think that, I had a number of very close friends, with South Asian heritage from a very young age. And so I certainly think that I was exposed to aspects of South Asian culture from when I was very young. My grandmother's second husband was Pakistani, and she had done a great deal of traveling in South Asia. She had lived in Bahrain for a number of years, teaching at an international school there. And when I turned 18, my grandmother took me to India for a trip, just the two of us. And it ended up being a really influential, really exciting, and really impactful trip that came at a really influential time in my life. And so I was lucky enough to go to a university, Indiana University, that taught a range of languages, including Hindi. And so I actually got into my academic study of South Asia through a fascination with language, specifically Hindi. And so I went to Jaipur to study Hindi with the AIIS, American Institute of India Studies. And once I became a master's degree student at Oxford in South Asian studies, I was encouraged to engage with Persian and Urdu as languages as well. And so that led me to Lucknow to study Urdu. And I just benefited from extremely generous mentors and friends who are willing to invest in me as someone who was not born and raised in South Asia, but were willing to guide me and give me the type of support that I needed to gain fluency in my research languages. And I think that the interest has just continued and consolidated and grown until it's a very important and a really essential part of my life. This is how I explain it. It's not really a linear story. I would say there's no one specific reason, but this project, I think I became fascinated by when I ran across the archive of the newspaper itself, and really not many people had looked at it. There was this treasure trove of information that was you know, fairly neglected up until the time when my supervisor Francis Robinson pointed me in the direction of it. And once I started reading the newspaper, I loved the experience of being immersed in its moral universe, if that makes sense. So reading day after day, seeing how conversations developed, getting a sense of, you know, how news items were interacting with each other. That polyphonic genre of the newspaper is just inherently really fascinating to me. And as someone who didn't grow up in South Asia, I found the conversations I had with the older men that grew up reading Medina, and alongside the experience of reading the newspaper, as such a treasured aspect of becoming more knowledgeable and more aware about the history of a subcontinent that I had come to love very deeply. So that's my best explanation, but I'm sure it will change the next time someone asks me.
Well, you never step in the same river twice, right? Yeah. And you know, whether it's newspapers or lives or Puranas, it's never a linear story. It's always a story within a story within a story.
Indeed.
That's always a scenic route. This is my philosophy. You know, the sense I get, whether this is inside or projection, who knows, you'll probably let me know. But the sense I get is that although you're reading a newspaper, you're reading sort of a nonfiction, right? You're reading some kind of journalism. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, in entering the world of that newspaper, it's not dissimilar from entering a narrative world where you pick up an ethos, you pick up a worldview, you pick up a set of values, you pick up a flavor, right?
Exactly. And I think I use that phrase moral universe because this is what my supervisor really, he used that phrase. He said, you know, you want to read the newspaper to try to get a sense of its moral universe. But really, that was a way of referring to that flavor. You know, how is the, and sometimes it's a little bit ineffable. Of course, you can deconstruct it and say, okay, these stories side by side are certainly playing a role here. But once I came to the University of Pennsylvania, I was benefiting from a department that spent a lot of time thinking about material culture. And this is really what gave me the nudge to think more seriously about lithography. And I realized that was the missing ingredient in my analysis. The flavor was inflected by this beauty of the script, by the kind of the images and by like the material production of the paper. And once I began to consider that, really a lot of pieces started to fall into place, that there was a way that the, you know, nastalik was inflecting the content, even when the content was, you know, fairly bland and pretty straightforward. you know, the inclusion of, you know, diacritics that were usually preserved for the Quran in the title of Medina that wasn't actually in Arabic was giving it a kind of halo that would implicitly reinforce this connection between an Urdu newspaper and the holy city of Medina.
No, it's beautiful. You may or may not know, but I study narrative primarily.
Yes, and yes, so, I am aware.
So,
yeah.
So there's this dual mode. You know, it's the analytical scholarly brain that needs to actually present the research and sift through the thoughts and relate it to theory and all that. But it's the instinctive storytelling brain that you need to first taste that rasa.
Yeah, rasa is such a good, and you said the word rasa, and that makes so much, that is exactly the right word, right? I know exactly what you mean. There is an intuitive aspect of the work, and this is why I think that, you know, I'm hoping my book will speak to literary scholars as well, right? Because there is an aspect of this work that's very coherent with, the aims of literary scholars. My undergraduate degree was actually in English literature. And so I have a rudimentary literary background that I'm sure comes to the fore sometimes when I'm thinking about how these genres in the paper are working together.
That's interesting. I started off my academic my studies. I started off as an English major.
Excellent.
English history, philosophy, totally artsy fartsy guy, obviously. Right. Then went away and worked for a while, came back, and I discovered I could do all that in religious studies through Sanskrit narrative.
Wonderful. Yeah. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about South Asian academic disciplines is there's so much rich interrelationship between disciplines. There's a lot of, it's really generative, I think, the way that South Asia area studies is very capacious and can intersect with a lot of different, apparently very siloed disciplines.
Well, there's a highly scientific way I can corroborate that, and it's as follows. I do this podcast, which really is one quote-unquote channel on the New Books Network, and there are about 100 such channels. They're dedicated to various subjects like Russian studies, philosophy. So I can tell by the number of times one of my podcasts are cross-posted to not one, two, but three different channels. It's like I'll do a podcast for Indian religions, and it'll be cross-posted to folklore studies, to history. In this case, probably to Islamic studies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a highly scientific way of engaging.
Yes, and it can have, it has its. I think it's wonderful in terms of how to work in a field that is so capacious is so exciting. But then it can also mean that it's sometimes complicated to kind of get the work out there, right? Because it's so easy for an interdisciplinary work to kind of fall between the cracks of specific disciplines. So I'm really grateful for the opportunity to talk about the book in more public ways, right? To really encourage and hope that people, at least a few people, might find the work interesting and useful.
Well, without question, I mean, the mission of New Books Network probably aligns very much with my own personal philosophy. It's just public outreach, public education, like sharing what we've come up with, letting people know these books exist, right?
Yes.
Folks can even have, I've heard back from profs who send students to these podcasts for certain research projects. They may listen to them because they may be remotely related to their field or not. And so I really, I myself am a little stymied and mystified at the ways in which the podcast is currently harnessed. And it started off as this kind of thing I did into a black box, and it still is. And it's just, I had a guest on. Timeless podcast land. I have no idea when. 2 months ago, 2 years ago, who knows? Probably closer to 2 months ago. But Lea Como, she was doing material culture in South Asia. She said this fascinating thing after, as you well know, before and after the recording, we'll chat for a couple of minutes. And she made a comment about the podcast being this living sort of, I can't remember the word she used, but the sense that I got was that it's an archive. It's a conversational archive. And what was strange for me is that in reading your book and seeing how you're looking back on the culture of the newspaper, it actually illumined for me what she was referring to about the culture that's being built around this podcast. But I'm too in it to see it.
I loved that comment because I think that in, you know, this podcast, we think that we're just talking about the books, right? We think that we're just here to talk about the, you know, the content that's underlying the podcast. But what's happening is we're contributing to and building up a culture of, you know, the academic podcast as well. And not just an academic podcast, a public podcast. We're trying to expand out of these smaller boxes of academic monographs to really have much wider and even more meaningful conversations with a much wider audience. And I think that's very similar to what the newspapers that I was studying were trying to do, is thinking about how to have really productive conversations across boundaries. But also what it reminds me of is I don't know if you caught this earlier, but I'm pretty sure, you know, as we keep talking, we're going to realize that we know about, you know, two or three dozen of the same people, and it will reveal the kind of smallness of the academic world, even though we're all very far flung geographically. And so, yes, you know, the space of, you know, where we are sitting right now. So right now I'm in Calgary. That's an important space, but also there is this imagined space of the network and conversation we're involved in. I loved that. I loved that reflection.
Wait, I'm a little slow on the uptake. You're at the University of Pennsylvania, are you not?
I am. Yes, yes, yes. But
you're in Calgary?
I am Calgary. So this semester, I am a Fulbright chair in South Asian Islam at the University of Calgary. And so I have been lucky enough to be able to enjoy right now the Canadian summer. The Canadian winter was a little bit more difficult, let me tell you. but I've been here since early March.
Listen, I've been in Toronto my whole life. And so I'm used to Torontonian winters, and Calgary's winter was quite difficult for me. You know, in Canada, I actually did my PhD at the University of Calgary.
I noticed that. Yes. Yes. I was looking at your personal website and I was like, hey, and to be honest, I thought that this was maybe one reason why, you know, we became connected. I was like, oh, maybe somehow, like, you know, this information was circulating somewhere. But no, I've been at the University of Calgary. Yeah. All semester. I've really been enjoying the classics and religious studies department here.
That's hilarious. I think right after I came back to Toronto, they merged, the Department of Religious Studies merged with the Department of Classics. And now it's Claire, Classics and Religious
Studies.
That's
right, Claire. Yes. And Claire has been so generous. I mean, it's been a difficult time, right, for everyone. So I do still spend a lot of time working, you know, at home. But people have been just so kind. And we've had lots of virtual meetings. And I'm hopeful that as the vaccine rates go up, we might be able to meet even more in person.
Megan, when did you start there, I ask, because I actually had the chance to teach an undergrad class at the University of Calgary while stationed physically in Toronto, and this was fall 2020.
Oh, great. Well, so I've only been here since March, so it's just a five-month research chair kind of visiting fellowship situation, and so I'll only be here for another month, and unfortunately, you know, it's always too short, but I'm working on my next project while I'm here on calligraphy and the emotions in not just newspapers, but also more broadly. So I'm looking at, by working on Medina, I became really fascinated with not just lithography, but the way that it was able to reproduce calligraphic forms. And so here in Calgary, I've managed to find some instruction in Nastaliq calligraphy, and I'm doing work looking at intellectual histories of calligraphy, formal histories of calligraphy, tazkiras of calligraphers, as well as looking at how calligraphers are cited and valorized in periodicals and magazines, so newspapers and magazines, so periodicals in general. And so that's what my next project will be about, calligraphy and the emotions and how those emotions may have changed from the late 19th century to the later half of the 20th century.
So rasa in writing is what you're doing. Great.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What is the role of emotions when we're looking at writing, right? And what I'm finding so fascinating is, first of all, emotions have very different roles depending on how you're approaching writing, right? If you're a calligrapher, you are perhaps working on calming or even neutralizing some of your emotions in the earlier part of your training, but and maybe emotions then are primarily useful as motivation. So your love for calligraphy is what's driving you forward through those difficult first stages. But for the true proficients, for the connoisseurs, emotions take on a different meaning is my hypothesis. They become something that can be actually very intricately integrated into someone's artistic expression in a very different way. But there's this profound shift that I'm seeing happening, I think, in how calligraphers are approaching emotions through their training. But then that also differs from the way that historians who aren't calligraphers but are trying to establish this connection or lineage between calligraphy and Islam, they're invoking emotions in a very different way. So I'm having a lot of fun with this early stage of the project so far.
That sounds fascinating. Once you finish that work, I know a podcast you can appear on.
I'd love it. Yes.
Great. Well, is there anything else you wanted to mention about the research before we close today?
No, I'm just very grateful to you for inviting me to have this really wonderful conversation.
Glad to be of service and also to gain clarity on what I'm doing here, in fact, which apparently is creating podcast culture. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. You should start taking notes. You need to start keeping a journal so that future generations of historians have something to work with.
I'll share some printouts on my Google Calendar at some point. I'm sure that'll suffice. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
So for those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Megan Eaton-Prop, who is assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, currently at my alma mater, University of Calgary, doing some exciting research. We've been talking about her fascinating new book, Print in the Urdu Public, Muslims, Newspapers, and Urban Life in Colonial India. Until next time, stay safe, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the rasa of books, newspapers, and podcasts.